From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we listen to some rare gospel recordings with Robert Darden, the founder of the Gospel Music Restoration Project. His goal is to digitize one copy of every gospel recording made between 1945 and 1970. Many of the recordings he's tracking down are 78s and 45s on labels that no longer exist. Director Ridley Scott has two movies in theaters now, American Gangster, which is nominated for 3 Golden Globes, and his new 25th anniversary edition of Blade Runner. We'll talk with him about both. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to listen to some great, and in some cases rare, gospel recordings. My guest, Robert Darden, is the founder of the Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University in Texas, where he also teaches. His goal is to digitize a copy of every black gospel recording made between 1945 and 1970, which he describes as the golden age of gospel. He's dealing with a lot of 78s and 45s that were issued on small labels which no longer exist. Darden is also the author of a book about gospel that was published a few years ago called People Get Ready. He was the gospel music editor at Billboard magazine for 10 years. Robert Darden, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
Before we talk about your gospel restoration project, let's start with a recording. And the recording I thought we could start with is one of the ones that you suggested. It's the State Choir of Southwest Michigan singing Going to Heaven to Meet the King. Tell us about this recording and its significance.
Well, this is the first commercial recording. It's about 1961 of the choir, the Church of God in Christ, or COGIC. And the COGIC is one of the big gospel music choir organizations across the country, under the direction of Maddie Moss Clark, and the Clark sisters, Quinky Clark and others, are her daughters. And this is very rare. The early mass choir recordings, which were also usually just pressed for the choir members in their churches, are hard to come by today.
So this is the first commercially released version of that kind of choir?
No. Part of the problem with the project is we don't know.
Oh.
There's so little record keeping. We have no idea. This is one of the first, and part of the problem is that mass choirs are so difficult to tape and record in those old recording days, so there are very few. So this is certainly the first with Maddie Moss and Clark, and it's hard to come by, but there may be earlier's.
Okay, well,
ones out there somewhere.
Well, let's hear it. This is the State Choir of Southwest Michigan, Going to Heaven to Meet the King, recorded in 1961. That's the State Choir of Southwest Michigan, recorded in 1961. That's really powerful.
You wonder how far away the microphones, and they're usually only using one or two, have to be to keep from being overdriven by that big, muscular, powerful sound by both the choir and the soloists. It's extraordinary.
Well, my guest is Robert Darden, and he heads the Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. And what you're trying to do here is to digitize just all the gospel recordings that you could find between the years 1945 and 1970. Why are those years bracketing your project?
Well, we had to set some delimitations, and the early gospel music stuff that is out of copyright has been well preserved because people can make money on it. And the later stuff is not quite so hard to come by. But during this classic era, particularly the 78s, the 45s, and the LPs, where they're still in copyright, nobody seems to really care about because there's no money to be made. So if it exists, it's in a warehouse, and if it's not in a warehouse, it's in an attic, or maybe it's been long since tossed in a landfill. But this is what we figured was the most at-risk era of all of black gospel music.
So if it's still under copyright, that means that record companies still have the material licensed, probably, right?
Maybe. Maybe they don't. We spent 2 years trying to track down one very fine label with some wonderful artists, and finally, after a two-year search, discovered that the label's rights were owned by Seagram's Liquor of Germany, and spent another year trying to find somebody who knew what they were talking about in Germany who spoke English, and finally got the gentleman on the phone, and he said, yeah, oh yeah, I shall, we own it. It's in America.
Part of this is like the conglomeratization of music. Seagram's bought Polygram and Universal, and both those labels had already bought a lot of smaller labels. Is that what you're running into?
In some cases, it's just that maybe it was the local Seagram's distributor, and he had gone bankrupt for other reasons, and as collateral, he had had a label that he had started, or he, his family, had started on the side, and they had to put that up as collateral. It may have not been anything that ever crossed the horizon for the main Polygram people, but it was something one family had done that had a few dozen recordings, and now it's gone.
Mm-hmm. So are you digitizing 45s that you find at flea markets as opposed to being able to go to the vaults of the record companies?
Yeah, we have had no access to record labels yet. What we have done is identified the 10, 15 biggest gospel music collectors around the world and have approached them systematically and asked them if we may just make a single digital copy of each piece of music that they have, and we'll return the originals to them. We'll make them a digital copy if they would like. We see it as kind of like those seed banks up around the Arctic Circle that keep one copy of every kind of seed there is in case there's another Dutch elm disease. I just want to make sure that every gospel song, the music that all American music comes from, is saved.
Well, it's a big job.
We're thinking that about 70% of all this music is lost, unaccounted for, out of print, and not available for love or money.
Well, the period that you're trying to preserve, 1945 to 1970, includes several years where secular music like rock and roll and soul music is so influenced by gospel. So I thought we'd hear a recording that you've brought with you of a rock and roll pioneer who recorded gospel after he was born again. So gospel probably influenced him, and then he goes back and records gospel. And this is Little Richard. Tell us the background to the recording that we're going to hear, Troubles of the World.
He fights this whole battle his whole career and is still fighting it now, by my understanding, being torn between the sacred and the profane. And at the very height of his career, leaves rock and roll and goes back, gets a recording studio, and pretty much self-finances a gospel album, how he thinks it needs to sound. And caught up in the throes of the spirit, he puts together this incredibly eerie, keening kind of opening, then brings in this wonderful, great mass, muscular choir of men to sing behind him. And it really sounds more Broadway than gospel, but I think it's one of the unique 2 minutes and 30 seconds on all of Wax right now.
And do you know who the female voice is that does the wordless vocal that opens this track?
That is Little Richard.
That's Little Richard? I thought it was a woman.
That is Little Richard.
Oh, wow. Man, it's really great.
He learned it from Marion Williams, who I hope we'll hear later in the show.
Wow, well, everybody's got to hear this. So this is Little Richard recorded in what year?
We're hoping we can nail this down at some point, but I'm guessing early 50s.
Okay.
I want to see my mother. I want to see.
That's Little Richard singing gospel, one of the recordings that my guest Robert Darden has brought with him. He is the founder of the Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, and also author of the book People Get Ready, A New History of Black Gospel Music. Well, that's really an incredible recording. Is that a rare recording? Was it difficult to find?
Yeah, any of the 45s from that era are hard to find, particularly for the gospel. This is on a tiny little, probably self-financed label called End.
So how did you find it?
This is one of a number of recordings that were made available to us by the gospel music collector and blogger Bob Maravich. He was the first of the collectors we went to, and he's made available to us for digitization his extraordinary collection of 45s and LPs. He also has a gospel music radio show in Chicago.
Why did you decide to start this gospel music restoration project?
As I was doing People Get Ready, I kept coming across these songs that everybody would cite as being influential. And then when I would try to find them, either to buy or just to listen to, I couldn't.
And so you figured you'd have to develop a database
yourself.
Well,
it's kind of an interesting story. I was so frustrated that after the book came out, I wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times that ran in February of 2005 saying, you know, this is a sin, people, that we have let this extraordinary legacy die, and future generations are going to judge us real harshly. And that's when Mr. Royce called and said, what we got to do? So I
This is the man who's funded your project.
And yes, Charles Royce in New York, who doesn't know anything about gospel music. And in fact, the first thing I sent him was the Marion Williams, They Took My Lord Away, trying to explain why this was important. And he said, do what you got to do, and I'll fund it. So I studied the Arhuli Collection, which is working with UCLA on the Mexican-American music like this. And found out what it would cost to set up a digitization lab and get a couple employees for a few years, just so that if I was right about this, this was most 70% of this music is lost forever, that at least we can begin the process of trying to save it. And that's just what happened.
My guest is Robert Darden, the founder of the Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University in Texas. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, Jesus. Oh, Jesus. Friend. Friend, when I'm friendly.
My guest is Robert Darden, founder of the Gospel Music Restoration Project. His goal is to digitize a copy of every gospel recording from 1945 to 1970. You know, in talking about the kind of cross-pollination between gospel and rock and roll and soul music, there's another track that you brought with you by the Little Lucy Smith Singers. Tell us about this and why you've chosen it.
Well, this was the group's big hit back in the 1950s. Little Lucy Smith was the granddaughter of Elder Lucy Smith, who founded Chicago's All Nations Pentecostal Church, and we think is the first African-American preacher to get her own radio program. Little Lucy Smith is a keyboard player, and she went on to accompany the Roberta Martin Singers. One of the early members of this group is Gladys Beeman Gregory, who is considered one of the best of Chicago's female gospel singers, which is a pretty big compliment when you consider that's where Mahalia Jackson came from.
There's something very girl group about this recording. And it's hard for me to know whether this is the kind of influence that the girl groups picked up on or whether this gospel group is influenced by secular music. What year did you say this is from?
This is back in the early 1950s. It would not surprise me that this kind of tough girl group sound would influence doo-wop. Certainly doo-wop has a huge amount of gospel influence. But again, they could have heard this on the radio and said, you know, that would be a nice fresh sound for us too.
So this is the Little Lucy Smith Singers, Somebody Bigger Than You and I. That was the Little Lucy Smith Singers, recorded in the 1950s, and my guest is Robert Darden, the founder of the Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. And his goal is to find and digitize every gospel recording that was made between 1945 and 1970, a very difficult, if not impossible, task. How did you discover gospel music?
My father was promoted to lieutenant in the United States Air Force, which, as you know, was the first of the services to be integrated. And he went out and with his $15 a month raise, bought a little tiny hi-fi and had enough money left over to buy three LPs. And I think one of them was Perry Como and one of them was Mondo Kane movie themes.
Mondo Kane.
And the third one was Mahalia Jackson's Christmas album. And the first time I heard that, my parents say that I could not get that voice out of my head. And being in the Air Force, which was integrated, meant that I was in and out of my friends' houses all the time, and I heard gospel from a very early age regularly. And it's just been an endless quest for me to continue trying to track down that voice and that thrill that it gave me the very first time.
Now, we should mention that you're white. Are there places that your love of gospel music has taken you that you otherwise never would have been exposed to?
There is a special treat to go to the black gospel churches in this country where they treat you like a long-lost son. Even you may be the only white face in the auditorium. And to sit down and listen to music which has an unbroken apostolic succession back to the spirituals, and to hear artists that are singing for the love of it, because God knows outside of Mahalia, none of them ever made any money, to continue to do what they love and to try to follow what they believe is a great commission. And it is a privilege every time I do it.
Is there a particularly interesting service that you've been to that you could tell us about?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I went to the Reverend Al Green's church in Memphis.
Oh, lucky you. Yeah.
It was, people go to Graceland, but the better show is just a couple miles up the road. It's a 3.5-hour service. I was one of only a couple white faces with a couple German and Japanese tourists. And the choir comes in their robes and their white gloves and this wonderful staccato beat. And he had an incredible choir, but even better band with two lead guitars and big Hammond B3 organ, bass, and drums. And every time you try to preach, somebody would get the spirit, usually the bass player or the keyboard player, and they'd do this kind of vamp, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, when he'd get in the cadence of preaching, the preacher that day. And all of a sudden, everybody would shoot up out of their seats, and the band would jump in, and it'd take about 15, 20 minutes to get things calmed down again, while the usherettes would be dancing in spirit circles, and everybody singing this kind of wordless glossolalia, and the incredible beat going on, and he would finally get people settled down again and begin preaching, and he'd get into a kind of a rhythm again, and all of a sudden the bass player, doo, 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 and it went on for 3.5 hours.
And what did you do, sit in your chair and watch or participate?
Well, I'm a drummer. I can keep a beat. I may be white, but I can keep a beat.
So, but did you just sit and watch, or did you jump up with everybody else?
I jumped and clapped. Uh-huh. On the beat, I had.
Well, let's hear another recording that you've brought with you from the period that you're trying to preserve, 1945 to 1970. And this is a solo recording by Marion Williams, who I believe is one of your favorite singers.
She is my all-time favorite. People talk about Mahalia Jackson, and the few times I've ever got the finger wag from black women is when I've said Marion is better than Mahalia. This is recorded live in Tony Hilbert's living room, by all accounts, on a cassette recorder.
Now, you describe this as a great example of surge singing in gospel. What does that mean?
Surge singing is a carryover from back in the old days, what they call Isaac Watts singing, where Dr. Watts was the first of the popular hymns that were being sung in the American churches in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s. Everything else had been in that particularly mournful shape note kind of sound, and you couldn't tap your toe, and there's no room for improvisation. But the Isaac Watts hymns, you could. So where they could sing them, and as you know, slaves weren't allowed to have religion, much less read through most of the history of slavery, they would hear these songs, and they would just love them, because you could play with the melody, you could stretch it out, and you could add this indefinable surge and beat. Is almost like an ocean sound coming out of the really good singers. I think the first time I ever heard that was with Marion Williams singing Amazing Grace on the Bill Moyer special on Amazing Grace, and it just galvanized people. And she was one of the last of the great practitioners of the old surge singing style.
Do you know what year this recording is from?
Ooh. I would guess 1970.
Okay. This is Marion Williams, They Led My Lord Away.
Well, they led my Lord away. They led him away. They led him away. They led my Lord away. He never said a mumbling word. They led my Lord away. He never said a mumbling word. Hey, not a word. Not a word did he say. For the victim of Calvary's hill.
Robert Darden is the founder of the Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University in Texas. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
He never said a mumbling word. They ripped him up Calvary's hill. He never said a mumbling word.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now exhibiting sculptures by Martin Puryear. More at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mary, Mary, what you gonna name that pretty little baby?
Coming up, Robert Darden plays one of the rarest gospel recordings he's restored, and director Ridley Scott talks about his two films currently in theaters, American Gangster and the new edition of Blade Runner.
Some call him one thing, think I'll call him Jesus.
Sweet Jesus.
Ain't it sweet?
Sweet Jesus, glory be to the newborn king.
Some call him Jesus, think I'll call him wonderful.
Wonderful.
He's so
wonderful. Glory be to the newborn king.
Some call him wonderful, think I'll call him Emmanuel. King
Emmanuel. Glory be to the newborn king.
Some call him Emmanuel. I'm gonna call him Prince of Peace.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Darden, the founder of the Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University in Texas, where Darden also teaches. His goal is to digitize one copy of every black gospel recording made between 1945 and 1970. Many of them are 78s and 45s on small labels that no longer exist. Darden is also the author of a history of gospel called People Get Ready. He was gospel music editor at Billboard for 10 years. Now, are you going to a lot of flea markets looking for 45s and 78s?
Every chance. And all of my friends are, too.
Where do you
we
go?
We ask.
Where do you go?
Well, a good place to go is, not surprisingly, in the black parts of town, where somebody's grandmother has died and the family is doing an estate sale, or maybe they're selling out the belongings. And somewhere in an attic or a back room, there's a stack of these old, well-worn, but well-loved 78s and LPs. And we're so early in the process that we're not being particularly discriminating. We're buying them all, and hopefully that there's going to be some things that's usable. The technology has advanced so far that even a 78 that looks completely flat like glass Most of the time, people's needles bias to the left or to right, but our engineer Tony can adjust our needle so if one side's flat, so we can pick the music off the other side, and we're getting wonderful recordings out of things that to me look like they were impossible.
You're trying to take the pops and the hiss out of the 45s and 78s?
No, we're doing a archival survival at this stage. We want to get everything. Since we're never going to make this commercially available, we're afraid that if we take the highs and the lows off, we'll lose some valuable data that we couldn't replace later. And it's easier to work with once they've been digitized to do whatever we want to, but we've got to get them down on digital now, how they are.
Now, one of the recordings you brought with you today is one that you describe as among the rarest in the collection that you've created. It's called Old Ship of Zion by the Mighty Wonders of Akwasko with John Stewart Jr. as the soloist. How did you find this, and how do you know that it's rare?
This was one of a number of 45s that came from the Bob Mirovich collection. He got it, as best we know, like you said, at a flea market. Maybe he came on eBay. He's just part of a larger group of materials. Mark, as best we've been able to research, is a custom label. So it means somebody could go in and put $25 down and record a song and then pay, you know, a few bucks each and maybe make 50, 100, 200 to sell at their performances or to give to radio DJs. But every database that exists and all of our serious collectors that we've checked with, nobody's heard of this. Nobody's heard of the song. Everything about this is a mystery. But the fact that it's a custom label doesn't really surprise me. But why this project is so exciting, here's a voice from somebody who's obviously influenced by Sam Cooke from his gospel days, to the point the first time I heard it, I thought it might have been Sam Cooke. It's obviously not. And yet, nobody would have ever heard it had we not saved it and you not played it on the air.
You know, I actually really like the recording, as I'm sure you do too.
I think it's wonderful. I think this guy had any exposure at all among the East Coast, where we think this is from, he could have been a star. This is a warm, sensitive voice with a lot of soul in it. This guy could have been big.
And I'm sure
he's big in Akwasko, Maryland.
And I'm sure our listeners will hear the similarity that you're talking about to Sam Cooke. So this is The Mighty Wonders of Akwasko, Old Ship of Zion, with John Stewart Jr. as the soloist.
'Tis the old ship of Zion. 'Tis the old ship of Zion. 'Tis the old ship of Zion. Step on board if you want to see Jesus. Step on board if you want to see Jesus. Just step on board and follow me. There's nothing but love.
The Mighty Wonders of Akwasko, The Old Ship of Zion, with John Stewart Jr. as the soloist. A really nice voice.
It's our engineer Tony's favorite out of all the thousands we've received so far.
So, are you keeping up with contemporary gospel and the cross influences now between gospel and various forms of pop music?
I am. I was gospel music editor for Billboard magazine for 10 years, in part so I could do the interviews with the old gospel, but it made me stay in touch with the more contemporary groups. I like the ones who pay more tribute to the music that's gone before them. There is a section of the black gospel music community now that, while it maintains the religious lyrics, the music is indistinguishable from what's on radio. And that's fine. Music continues to evolve as it has since slavery. But what particularly moves me, what grabs me, is the quartets and the soloists from the 40s, 50s, 60s.
You know, you've said about this gospel music restoration project that you're working on that you know you'll die before you finish the project. Because the project is so vast. And I thought, that's such a beautiful thought that you know you're going to devote your life to this. And at the same time, it's a sad thought that it's impossible, that the project is so vast, you know it's impossible to see it to completion.
It is, and it's not because there's hundreds of thousands of recordings out there. It's because there are so few, and it's going to take so long to track down the ones to fill in the holes, and that we're going to come to a conclusion at some point on a number of them that not for love, not for money, and not if I had all the money at Baylor University's journalism department at my command, would I find that song. And as I was working on the People Get Ready book and would write about these songs that everybody cites as being the most influential in their life, know that I'll never hear that song. I'll die, and maybe I'll hear it in heaven, I hope, but I will never hear it on this earth, and I don't know that anybody alive ever will again.
Hmm. I don't know if this is too personal or not, but when you're at churches going to hear the gospel music, do you relate at all to the Christian aspect of it?
I do. I grew up in the Christian church. I'm a Baptist. So since a great number of these churches are Baptist, doctrinally, it's right down my alley. Not a problem at all.
And have you sung?
Do I sing?
Uh-huh.
I would. If they invited me, one of the great highlights of my life would be to play the drums behind one of these groups, but I would never in a million years sing.
Okay.
I would be so intimidated, my ears would fold up.
Well, I thought it would be nice to close with a Christmas song, and you brought a terrific version of Joy to the World with you. Tell us where this is from.
One of the very first, if not the first, all-black musicals on Broadway was Black Nativity, based on the Langston Hughes book, and with music by the great Professor Alex Bradford. Why this is so extraordinary, and there's been some later revivals that have been very nice, but this one from the early, I think this one particular copy of 61, it has two of my favorite singers on it, the very rough and powerful Princess Stewart, and then once again my hero, Marion Williams. And this arrangement is just hard to beat. I don't know of anything out there now that could meet this for power and for great sheer funkiness and joy of life.
We should point out it's not Marion Williams singing lead on this, it's somebody much younger.
Yeah, that's Princess Stewart.
That's Princess Stewart. Okay, yeah. Okay. Well, I want to wish you a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
And God bless us all. And if you've got black gospel music, I'm at Baylor University. I'll take care of you.
Okay. Robert Darden, thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Robert Darden is the founder of the Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University in Texas, where he also teaches. The 25th anniversary edition of the film Blade Runner has just been released. Coming up, Ridley Scott talks about directing Blade Runner and American Gangster, which has been nominated for 3 Golden Globes, including Best Director and Best Dramatic Movie. This is Fresh Air. My guest Ridley Scott has two films in theaters now, American Gangster and the new 25th anniversary edition of his science fiction film Blade Runner. Blade Runner was a box office flop in 1982, yet it inspired a futuristic look that was copied in everything from hotels to rock videos. Based on a story by Philip K. Dick, Blade Runner is about androids called replicants who look just like humans, were designed as slave labor to colonize other planets, and have a 4-year lifespan. They're illegal on Earth. Blade Runners, like the one played by Harrison Ford, have the job of hunting down and executing escaped replicants found on Earth. Harrison Ford's character, Deckard, falls in love with a replicant, played by Sean Young. Before the film was released, Ridley Scott made some changes based on test screenings and firm studio advice. He added a hard-boiled Harrison Ford voiceover. The romantic ending, when Harrison Ford and Sean Young go off together, sounded like this.
Gaff had been there and let her live. 4 years, he figured. He was wrong. Tyrell had told me Rachel was special. No termination date. I didn't know how long we'd have together. Who does?
For the 10th anniversary director's cut of the film, Ridley Scott removed the tacked-on ending. No voiceover, no romantic music. What you hear as Harrison Ford and Sean Young leave together is the cynical voice of a fellow Blade Runner reverberating in Ford's head. That's also the ending on the new digital Final Cut, which is in theaters and on DVD.
It's too bad she won't live. But then again, who does?
Ridley Scott, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start by talking about the new edition of Blade Runner in theaters and on DVD. The film was made 25 years ago. The future in that film is set in 2019. 2019 is only 11 years away. So we're 25 years away from the date the film was made, but only 11 years away from this distant future that the film projected. So in that context, does your whole sense of the future change when you think of 2019 now?
I thought the reason how it evolved when I first made Blade Runner was I was traveling a lot in the Far East and Hong Kong particularly. I thought it was very fascinating. That was a time when there was before skyscrapers in Hong Kong and lots of those beautiful junks in the harbour. And I was also spending a lot of time in New York, which always seemed to be perpetually on overload. Both places sank in, and I thought the film should take on, be an evolution of those two places and where they might be going in 2019. Notwithstanding, New York is now a very beautiful place, very clean, and for I think it seems to be pretty well run. So it really isn't taking the place of Blade Runner 2019. Everything's much cleaner than I expected. Hong Kong now is a beautiful city with fantastic skyscraper skyline, so I think I better move the date back a little bit.
You've changed the ending from the original. The original ending is kind of optimistic. Harrison Ford and Rachel the replicant, played by Sean Young, begin a life together. And it looks like they're going to get away from this dystopian world into a better one. Mm-hmm. In the new version, they go off together too. But in the new version, I wasn't sure or not, but it seems like Harrison Ford might be a replicant himself.
That's true.
A lot of clues about that. So can we say that he is or is not one?
He is definitely a replicant.
He's definitely a replicant. And did you intend that all along? Did you intend first time around for us to walk away thinking, he was a replicant too?
Yeah, always. That sequence where he actually walks out having taken her out of his apartment and she's now standing in the elevator, and he stops because his foot touches something, and actually it's a origami, origami meaning a little objects that people fold up and make little creatures and birds and things. And this origami, he holds it up, and it's a unicorn. And if you watch Harrison very closely, he actually, in his uniquely wry way, he wryly nods as if he's just had the truth confirmed, and then walks into the elevator, the doors close, and that's the end of the movie. That's a real film noir, right? And that's what the film was always designed to be.
The world as you've created it in Blade Runner, it's raining all the time. It's mm-hmm. kind of dirty. Everything is basically gray. Mm-hmm. People don't talk the same language, and like the Harrison Ford character is often surrounded by a language that I'm not sure he understands. And the food,
city screen.
The food is really disgusting, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. often eaten in an outdoor counter with mm-hmm. an awning, so that you're kind of nearly eating out in the rain. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about, I never read the Philip K. Dick story that this is based on, so I don't know whether mm-hmm. you're following his vision mm-hmm. of what a city might be like in the future, and how much of this comes from your imagination.
Well, I think Philip got angry with me because I'd said I couldn't get through the book because it was so dense. And I hope I fixed that before he died by showing him the first 10 minutes of the movie, which were preparing, slotting in the special effects. So I'd brought Philip Dick down to EEG in Santa Monica to say, listen, I know you're upset, and I tried to make it up to him. Look at this. This is what I've been doing. And he was absolutely stunned, I think. He said, but you've read Men in a High Castle. I said, no, I haven't. And he said, my God, this is what this Terrell character is. No, basically, there's a lot of imagination involved in that, and endless discussion with the production designers, but you know, particularly Sid Mead, because I can draw, so I can scribble and draw quite well, actually. And so you're able to have a lot of discussions on a pad with Sid Mead speculating, saying, and he's a designer who speculates from social order and social disorder. So every design is actually designed for a reason of social conditions. So that's, which is always the best designers. And so I was fascinated by all of that. So what we were doing is evolving the world while I was writing with Hampton.
I can't believe you didn't read the Philip K. Dick story. No wonder he was insulted.
I tried. There's 19 stories in the first 6 pages, you know. And I think what Hampton had done was distilled a story down to the hunter falls in love with his quarry. And you set that in a world where the quarry are replicants. And they're not called replicants in the Philip Dick book. I think they're called androids. And we didn't want to use the word android or humanoid or robot because we felt it needed to be more updated. And it, actually, the name replication or replicant came from a student of biology at, I think, Carmel, or, who was the daughter of David Webb Peoples, I think, who said, I said, we've got to find another name for this thing. And she came back and said, well, what about the word replicant or replication? So that's how that happened.
My guest is director Ridley Scott. His 25th anniversary final cut of Blade Runner is in theaters. A new Blade Runner DVD collection includes all the versions of the film, as well as extras about making it. Ridley Scott will talk about his film American Gangster after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Ridley Scott. His films include Blade Runner, Gladiator, and Black Hawk Down. He also directed American Gangster, which is currently in theaters, and is nominated for 3 Golden Globes. Denzel Washington stars as a drug kingpin in Harlem. Russell Crowe plays the detective trying to bring him down. Here's a scene after Crowe has succeeded in busting Washington. Crowe is talking with Washington in prison, and Washington asks him this question.
Let me ask you this. Do you really think that putting me behind bars is going to change anything on them streets? Them dope fiends are going to shoot it. They're going to steal from it. They're going to die for it. Putting me in or out ain't going to change one thing.
And that's the way it is.
That's just the way it is. So what we got, Richie? We got me and you sitting here.
I got possession, supply, conspiracy, bribing a law officer. I got people who attest to seeing you kill in cold blood. I got your offshore bank accounts, your real estate, your businesses. All bought with money from heroin. And I got hundreds of parents of dead kids. Addicts who OD'd on your product, and that's my story for the jury. That's how I make it all stick. This man murdered thousands of people, and he did it from a penthouse driving a Lincoln. Aside from that, you got nothing to worry about.
That's pretty good. But that's why we go to court, isn't it, Richie? Because I got witnesses, too. I got celebrities. I got sports figures. I got Harlem, Richie. I took care of Harlem, so Harlem's going to take care of me. You can believe that.
Your film American Gangster has been nominated for several Golden Globes, including there's Best Motion Picture Drama, Best Director, and Denzel Washington, Best Actor in a Drama. Am I leaving any out?
No, that's it. That's good.
That's it. That's pretty good. Denzel Washington plays a drug kingpin in Harlem who manages to get a direct contact in, is it Vietnam or Thailand, for his supply?
Vietnam.
Vietnam, yeah. And he gets wealthier and wealthier and more powerful as the movie goes on. Russell Crowe plays the cop who's trying to take him down. And, you know, the cop in the story, he's very honest in his working life, but he never really played it straight with his wife, and she's suing for divorce. Whereas, you know, the gangster is very loyal to his family, even though he's totally illegal and corrupt. So the contrast in these two characters, was there a similar contrast in the two actors and their approach to acting? We, you know, like Russell Crowe, you've worked with before in a couple of films, including Gladiator. How would you compare his approach to acting to Denzel Washington's? Did you work with them in different ways?
Yeah, I mean, similar in a way because, you know, when you've got a level of intelligence that actually, and therefore intelligence and stroke sensitivity, that both men have. You know, somebody said well, Denzel's a kind of method actor, but I often wonder what that means. I think it means that somebody absolutely does his homework inside out every which way on the character that he's about to portray, and in so doing is making selections and rejections of what to do and what not to do. And, you know, Russell's the same thing. So if that's what method is, then they both live it. They live it. So in that sense, they're very similar. Russell's a obsessive researcher about everything he's doing, so he knows everything that he's about to play, as does Denzel. So there's, funny enough, there's a similarity to them both. So you got to be at your best when you meet with them and deal with them, because they'll ask questions all the time that you've got to be sure that you have the answer.
Give me an example of a question you were asked that you needed to supply an answer to.
Well, how much did I know about Harlem? Had I done research? Had I met Frank Lucas yet? Because you have to, and this is all within a couple of weeks of me coming on board. Unfortunately, I was able to say, well, actually, I was in Harlem in 19. Here to tell you this, pal, I was in Harlem in 1961. I used to go around and do a lot of photographs at that particular moment.
And you did a lot of what? And
photographs.
I
was going to be a still photographer, so I did a lot of stills of Harlem, Coney Island, you know, the Bowery. All of these places were war zones in those days. And I think when you got a camera and you're a photographer, you don't even think about any danger. So I always remembered it. And so as I was reading Steve's script, I could literally smell it, you know, the whole environment. It was kind of pretty easy to take on board and get into it.
So what was most difficult in changing when you were shooting on location in Harlem, most difficult to bring back to a 1960s look? The film is set between, 68 and 73?
Finding the war zone. it's all cleaning up. All those brownstones have become $5 million townhouses. I mean, since the last two mayors, you know, Bloomberg and Giuliani, they've really cleaned it up. I mean, the right through past Columbia University, right through Harlem, Manhattan's never looked so good, right? So it was really trying to be allowed to, you know, waste the streets as I remember it. And they were really helpful. It was tremendous. Much easier than I expected it to be. I thought it was going to be much tougher. It was going to be really hard to shoot in Harlem. We shot in 180 locations with 130 speaking parts. That is a lot. But it was in very... it's almost like shooting a documentary, actually.
Ridley Scott, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ridley Scott's film American Gangster is nominated for 3 Golden Globes. The 25th anniversary edition of Scott's film Blade Runner is on DVD and in theaters.
Bells will be ringing. The glad, glad news.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Patty Leswing, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Wish me greetings once again. Crowds will be singing, silent night. Christmas carol by candlelight. Please come home for Christmas. Please come home for Christmas. If not for Christmas, by New Year's night. Friends and relations send salutations.
Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the Irish rock film Once on DVD Tuesday. From the families who own Cabot Creamery, makers of naturally aged Vermont cheddar since 1919. Recipes and health tips are at CabotCheese.com. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Ship of Ghosts, the story of the USS Houston by James Hornfisher. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After working together on the film A History of Violence, director David Cronenberg and actor Viggo Mortensen teamed up for the film Eastern Promises. It's about to be released on DVD. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from Cronenberg and Mortensen. Join us for the next Fresh Air.